look, there's a reason demagogues rise to power, because typically when that happens, and as you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. We've seen it in the United States. We're seeing it happen in Europe. You know, the people who tell the simplest stories with the most emotional appeal become popular. And as we know, the simplest stories are often the least true, because the truth of life is complex. And a certain kind of clever politician, not all, but a certain kind of clever politician appeals to people's distrust of complexity. And that's a problem.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Mathilde Fasting, and today I'm joined by Professor of Humanities at Bard College, Daniel Mendelssohn. We're going to discuss his latest book, Three Rings, A Tale of Exile, Narrative, and Fate. But we will inevitably also talk about his two books, An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic, and The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million. A review of the book, Three Rings, says, combining memory, biography, history, and literary criticism, Three Rings weaves together the stories of three exiled writers who turned to the classics of the past to create masterpieces of their own, works that pondered the nature of narrative itself. So, welcome, Daniel.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What is it to be a storyteller?
I think about this more and more, both, as you know, I do a lot of work as a literary critic as well as a writer. So I'm on, so to speak, both sides of the fence. So I think about it both as a writer and as a critic. And I began to think about this question of the way that storytelling structures our experience. I think people tend to think of storytelling as the result of experience. You know, things happen and then you talk about it. But it was particularly when I was interviewing Holocaust survivors that I started to think about the way that our need to frame our experience as narrative conditions the way we experience real life. So it's a kind of a circle, so to speak. Things happen, but we need to turn it into a story in order to make sense of it, even to ourselves. So I think storytelling is not just something that we do for other people, so to speak, but we need to package the random facts of life, so to speak, the random events of life, as narrative in order to be able to really to understand it. It's obviously a point that certain schools of psychoanalysis really depend on, right? But I was very struck when, you know, this is now 20 years ago when I was researching The Lost, my Holocaust book, that as I saw these survivors struggling to explain to me these unimaginably traumatic events that had happened to them, the way that it had to be presented in a sort of Aristotelian package, a beginning, a middle, and an end, as Aristotle tells us, good literature must have. And so I think a lot about storytelling now. I think, you know, in English, storytelling, just the word storytelling, has a slightly naive quality. It's something you immediately associate with children, childhood.
Yes.
But of course, as we know, it's a very sophisticated process. And as you know, my new book, Three Rings, is an attempt to sort of struggle with the space between the elegant narrative and the raw material of life and the strange ways in which those two things interact, you know. But I think about it more and more. I mean, I think to some extent, the four books that I've written of memoir or narrative, nonfiction, whatever you want to call it, are all struggling with this problem to some extent. And I try to sort of put the struggle on the surface of the narrative, which is how am I telling this story? You know, I'm always sort of self-conscious in the book itself about my ability to tell the story, because I think I want to share the struggle with the reader, to make the reader aware that I myself am worried about my ability to tell this story. Mm.
You used a word in there, you said memoir, and memory is also, I think, connected to what you were trying to explain here, because how to memorize things would be to make up a story.
Yes. And look, it's what we do, right? I mean, it seems to me that memories act upon us in one of two ways. And the more unsettling way is fragmentary. You know, things pop up. We know this. And this, of course, is also a very Proustian notion, the idea of accidental recall. The cup of tea tripping over a stone.
The smell.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And then, but again, what I think we are trying to do, and one could say all of Proust's novel, you know, is a very long narrative trying to explain that one cup of tea, you know, I mean, it's right. But we're unsettled by the sort of dreamlike fragments of memories that emerge in our lives. And then we try to take those pieces and turn them into a story, because we can't just live with the fragments.
Yeah, because then you also used another word, dream. I'm actually talking to an artist right now. He says, when you dream something in the morning, it's for you in your head. You wake up and you think about your dream, start thinking about it. Mm. And then you come and you think it's so crazy or spectacular what you have dreamt that you tell it to somebody.
Yes.
You tell it to your husband or to your children or whenever, a friend. And then he says, at the moment when you start telling about your dream, it's not your dream anymore. It becomes a story.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that it's interesting that you mention that, because a comment that was made to me while I was doing the interviews for my Holocaust book, there was a group of survivors that I located from this little Polish town where my family lived. And one of them refused to be interviewed for a very long time. And I was very curious about them, because the others were very eager to share their stories and to have them be known. You know, they had a great
pride.
Fear that, well, yes, yeah. But also a fear that this would disappear, that nobody would remember. And this one woman refused to tell me her story until I finally prevailed on her. And then she made all these conditions, you know. But she said to me something that reminds me of what you just said. She said, if I tell you my story, it will become your story.
Yes.
She said, you'll put it in your book and then it won't be my life anymore. And I was very struck, because it's a very sophisticated perception, right? She understood something and she was right.
Yes.
You know.
So, and that's also, if we, your book, the first book, is also about history, of course, because it's history to everyone. Well, of course, a personal history for people who've lived through. I mean, you can have a direct connection to it, but for most people, it's not. It's history. Mm. So what is the difference between history and stories? You once said that history is only an increasing amount of details, but that the emotional details cannot be measured. And psychologically, I've often heard that if you tell a story, this is what is remembered, and not all the facts and details. So what does... How do you connect it to history? Well, in order to remember, in order to explain.
You know, it's funny, because in, you know, English, the English language has a problem that a lot of other languages do not have, which is that we have two separate words, history and story. Although in German, you say Geschichte, and it could be either a story you're telling your friend or history with the capital H, the same in French, histoire. So, and what is it in Norwegian? Probably the same
thing. Historia.
Yeah. So.
Or it could be another word. It could be, like you said, story for children. You would say eventyr, fortelling. So, and fortelling is also a kind of a story, which is more a story than history.
Yeah.
So actually maybe the,
it's more parallel. Yeah. So I think about that because I think we tend to think of history as a, say, as an academic subject, as an enterprise, as a record of facts about things that happened in the past. And historians are people who accumulate as many facts as they can in order to say, this is what happened. And whereas we think of a story, again, story is a sort of emotionally richer word, I think, in English. A story is already a structured object. As we know, events in real life are random and they happen for reasons, but not necessarily, they don't necessarily have a shape. And when we think of a story, as I was saying before, you know, it has a beginning, a middle, an end, and a lesson of some kind, maybe. And of course, good historians, as we know, are also good storytellers. The great historians, and this goes for Thucydides to Theodore Mommsen to, you know, many modern historians as well, Tom Holland, we were just talking about earlier today, are great storytellers. So the story, one could say, is the package in which history comes. That is to say, the facts about the past, insofar as we can know the facts about the past. But I think that, so I'll tell you a story about the difference between history and story. When I was on my book tour for The Lost, during the question and answer, a woman stood up and she said, you know, I'm so happy that, you know, the Holocaust is such a huge subject, but at least you've told everything that happened in this one little town. And I laughed and I said, you know, if I told everything that happened, even everything that I know that happened, which is itself not everything that happened, the book would be 3,000 pages long and nobody would read it because people want a story, even if it's a true story. You know, so these are very interesting. It comes back to your original question about narrative and storytelling. We as a species, I think, have a craving for a story. It seems to be a kind of primitive impulse. And the problem is, and this is something I've written about in The Lost especially, is the process of turning what happened into the story of what happened necessarily eliminates.
Lots of
you can't include everything. You don't want there to be repetitions. There's some things you don't think are important. So that process of erosion that necessarily turns, let's say, history into a story is something I worry about. So that my book, so look, my book is 500 pages long in English. That's a long book. But it's not everything I know. It's not every fact that I heard. You couldn't read that book, except if you're a historian. Hmm. See, so we keep stumbling over this problem, I think. And I can say, well, everything in my 500 pages is true as I could make it. But I had to leave things out. Sometimes people repeated themselves, or sometimes I heard two stories that were so similar that I didn't include one of them because the reader wants a story. So that is something I'm endlessly interested by, and something that in my new book I'm also wrestling with. What is the relationship of the past to the story that we tell about the past?
Mm-hmm. And also that brings me into another question that I'd might wanna if you have any thoughts on that. It's for stories also in politics, you see that stories is the thing that probably works the best. It appeals to people will have simplicity.
Sure.
They would want to understand things very rapidly.
Yeah.
You tell a story that, as you just said, cannot be everything. It's just something that you pick and choose and you make a story out of it. And of course, it comes into your emotions quickly. The most successful stories are the ones that talk to you, not to your brain, but to your heart.
Yeah.
And have you thought about how, well, that can be used and misused?
Yes. Are you kidding? After the last 5 years of American politics.
I'm not kidding.
It's all I think about.
It's all you think about.
Well, look, there's a reason demagogues rise to power, because typically when that happens, and as you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. We've seen it in the United States. We're seeing it happen in Europe. You know, the people who tell the simplest stories with the most emotional appeal become popular. And as we know, the simplest stories are often the least true, because the truth of life is complex. And a certain kind of clever politician, not all, but a certain kind of clever politician appeals to people's distrust of complexity. And that's a problem. So you get these demagogues, you get these people who are great simplifiers, and that's, we're seeing a lot of that lately. Nobody wants to hear, you know, I always think that the pivotal moment in the past, maybe the past century of American politics, many people will disagree with me, was the 1980 election, in which Ronald Reagan crushingly defeated the incumbent Jimmy Carter. And if you look at I remember it very clearly, I was at university, and Carter was this sort of agonized figure who was trying to talk about the problems of American society and wanted us to have a great national soul searching and reckoning. And Reagan, you know, as we know, is a former actor, you know, is basically giving people simple happy talk. We're great. We need to be great again. You know, we're the city on the hill, all of that. So who do you think won? The person who's saying we need to struggle with complexity and look at our demons and our dark side, or the guy who's giving you a one sentence summary of American civilization, which is we're great. That's a problem, you know. Mm. I worry about it.
But back to your writing process here, because it's fascinating reading your last book, The Three Rings, because you explore your own progress, or writing progress, also in that book, and you say you struggle to find a key. And why is that so difficult?
Well, this was it's a little book, my new book, but it tries to cover a lot of territory.
Has a lot of things in it.
I think ultimately, as I say, I think it's a kind of exploration of the connection between real life and the narratives that we make out of real life. But it, I think, necessarily begins with a story, which is true, of the struggle that I had in writing my book, which is called An Odyssey. I had finished writing The Lost, which is a very emotionally draining experience. And I was in this kind of, you know, a friend of mine said it was like post-traumatic stress. Not really, but you know, I was just sort of emptied after this very intense 5-year experience of researching and writing the book. And I just couldn't think of anything to write, and I didn't know what to write. And I started to have this idea about a book about the Odyssey and my father and all that, but I couldn't find the right structure. And that struggle with finding the right structure. So, you know, the book is really about the last year of my father's life, which just happened to be refracted, let's say, through the Odyssey in different ways. In January, he decided he was going to be a student in my seminar on Homer's Odyssey, which was a rather comic experience. And then in the summer, we went on this cruise that recreated the voyages of Odysseus, the hero of the Odyssey. And then he fell ill in the autumn and died a few years later. So I wrote the manuscript, which is sort of describing those three experiences, the classroom, the cruise, and the illness and death of my father. And it was just inert. It wasn't working as a story. And I kept thinking, why is this not working? Then I was talking to a friend of mine, and who's a famous editor in New York and a mentor of mine. And he said, well, the problem is you're telling it chronologically from A to Z, and it has no tension. He said, what people really are interested in is the classroom, which follows the Odyssey. You know, we do a little bit of the Odyssey each week. He said, you have to find a way to make the classroom the backbone of the book and then work in the cruise and the illness and death using flashbacks, flash forward, but make it more complicated, you know, give the narrative more, which is in fact how Homer tells story. That was the joke, was that, you know, here I was teaching about a text with a very complicated circular narrative, but I had failed to learn the lesson. So the book is really starts with this reflection on different ways of telling a story. We can tell stories chronologically, you know, beginning, middle, and end, or you can, this is one of the most famous phrases in literary criticism, you can start in medias res, in the middle, and then flash back to the beginning and flash forward to the end, which we like more because it has more texture. So that, in my new book, that becomes a moment to reflect on structures of storytelling, why certain kinds of structures are interesting. Like think of the flashback, for example, which I use and which is, of course, not just in literature, it's in cinema, all kinds of things. You know, why do we love flashbacks? You know, think of the many wonderful television shows that everybody's watching now, you know, The Bridge, this, that, the other, you know. We love flashbacks because it reminds us of how we remember things. It seems to have a kind of reality, a kind of psychological reality. So that's what the book is starting with, is a kind of struggle to figure out the right way to tell a story and then to reflect on what do we even mean when we say the sentence, the right way to tell a story?
Yeah, because there are different ways of doing it.
Yeah. But,
and you also start, well, you said what you started with, and that's the story about how you wrote the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. But you also, in the beginning, you have a quote. And the quote is from the Decameron. Mm-hmm. And it's about rings. So what does the ring and this story symbolize, the little story, which is the, I think you said it's the third story, is it?
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is this famous legend. It's in many cultures, actually, both Eastern and Western, about the king who has three sons, and he loves them all equally, and he wants to find a way to divide up the inheritance equally. And he has this one ring, which is supposed to go to the heir. And he decides he's going to have two other copies made, indistinguishable from the first. And that so no one will know which is, so to speak, the real ring. So this, it's also a famously a parable about three great religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It's often seen as a parable about God's relationship to these three religions equally. They're all equally good. And so I take that as the starting point because my book is about three different writers.
Yes.
But the idea of one kind of narrative being a sort of circular kind of narrative and circles within circles, and each one of the circles is equally interesting, is something that I want to begin with, which is why I start with that story from Boccaccio.
Yes. Yeah. So then, and then you come on to, we'll do this first, the ring stories, because you've chosen three different authors and they have written really very, very different books in many ways. I wouldn't imagine in the beginning that you should put those three together, but you have done that. And maybe it's because they kind of, they are connected to the Odyssey in some way.
Yes. Or
they are. And you also start, all the chapters have this very, I think, working well, because you have this start and you repeat it. And when I first read the first start and then I saw it repeated again, I said, okay, this is coming again. I've read this before. Yes, I have. And then it came again and again, and I understood why. So you're actually using a bit of Homer in your book as well. But the three books you have chosen here is the Mimesis book. That's a classic for everyone who's studying history. He's written that book, as you say, in Istanbul. And Odysseus Scar is one of the that's his first chapter. And then François Fénelon, who's chosen to write something that continues the Odyssey. He's written about the adventures of Odysseus' son, Telemachus, and it's a fiction. And then finally, a quite recent author, the German novelist Sebald, who flees to England, and he also writes about persons and people. He's moving about having thoughts, he's writing them down, and then he's reflecting on how it is. He's actually on a small travel himself, especially in the book that also has rings in the title.
The Rings of Saturn.
Yes. Mm. So, but he is not going in this wide area that Homer describes in the Odyssey. He is going in a quite small circles.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell me about this.
Well, this book, Three Rings, really began with material that I had accumulated while I was writing an Odyssey, my Odyssey book. And there was a point when I was writing that book where I became very interested in the reception of the Odyssey over the centuries. How were people reading the Odyssey in the East, in the West? And I was interested in Erich Auerbach, the great German scholar who wrote Mimesis, one of the great studies of Western literature.
Tell the listeners what that title means.
So Auerbach, a great German scholar of Renaissance literature and many other things as well, fled from Hitler, ended up in Istanbul teaching at the university, and it was there during the war that he wrote his great masterwork, which is a survey of 20 centuries of Western literature from Homer. It goes right up to Virginia Woolf and Proust in the final part. Looking at representative texts from each of these 20 centuries, basically, and exploring, and it's such an interesting idea, how does literature, a certain kind of literature, make things feel real? You know, when you're reading a book, why do you believe in the reality that it presents?
Why?
And it's a very interesting question. And so mimesis is the Greek word for imitation.
Yeah.
So how does literature imitate reality in a persuasive way? And as you mentioned the name of the first title, The Scar of Odysseus. And in the first chapter of Mimesis, he contrasts two kinds of literature, which correspond to the twin pillars of Western civilization, the Greco-Roman and the biblical, the Judeo-Christian. And he contrasts a moment in Homer's Odyssey, which is why I'm interested, in which Odysseus, he's come back after his 20 years being away. He's in disguise. He's trying to infiltrate his own palace to see who has been loyal and who has betrayed him. And in disguise, he's given a foot bath as a matter of traditional courtesy. And an elderly maid recognizes on his leg a scar, which only Odysseus could have. So the scar becomes the symbol of the recognition. Even though he's in disguise, he can't disguise the scar, which is to say you cannot disguise your own history, to come back to our other subject. And Auerbach takes this, and at that moment when she sees the scar, the narrative stops and goes back. There's two flashbacks. First, how did he get the scar? When he was a teenager, he was on a hunt and he got injured. Why was he on the hunt? There's a further flashback. When he was a little baby, his grandfather said, one day you'll come back and we'll go hunting together. So Auerbach uses this moment as the sort of great example of ring composition, as we call it in classics, this way of telling stories as a series of flashbacks, each one of which gives you more and more information. With this Greek way of telling a story, Auerbach contrasts the biblical way, and he uses the episode from Genesis of the sacrifice of Isaac. which, unlike the Greek way, which wants to constantly interrupt itself to give you more and more flashbacks, to give you more and more information so you know everything when you finally come back to the bathtub, so to speak. He says, well, you know, it's interesting because in the Bible, the author of the Bible, whoever that is, leaves out many things. So they go to the place of sacrifice, but you're not told where is the places that they travel through, who do they see, blah, blah. And to Auerbach, the biblical storytelling technique, which leaves things out, and then you wonder, how did they travel? What route did they take? Who did they meet? You're never told. He thinks it's more realistic, which of course is his great interest. How does literature represent reality? Because of course, in real life, we don't know everything. Everything is not a series of flashbacks that fill in all the blanks. And so I begin my book by pondering these two techniques of story. The Greek, which I call the optimistic, which assumes, so to speak, that if you had enough space, you could say everything about reality, right? You could make circles and circles and flashbacks and flashbacks. And the Hebrew way, the biblical way, which is pessimistic, I call it, which always is convinced that you cannot know everything. And that, paradoxically, is more realistic. And that becomes, for me, I sort of trace these two ways through two further texts, which you've mentioned. So one is François Fénelon in the late 17th century, who's the tutor to the grandson of Louis XIV, the Sun King. And as a kind of educational, ethical storytelling for his young pupil, the future king, he creates a kind of fan fiction based on the Odyssey, which takes the character of Odysseus's son and gives him a whole new series of adventures. And of course, they're supposed to be educational for the king, and all the adventures have a little moral at the end. And this was the best-selling book in Europe for 100 years. No one reads it now, but it was very important in the Enlightenment. And so I say, well, this is a kind of the optimistic narrative that you can keep making more circles within the original text, you know, sequels, fan fictions. We do it today, of course. And then the final chapter of my book, so that Fénelon is the second chapter. In the final chapter, I write about Sebald, the German novelist who died 20 years ago. All of whose books seem to me to be expressions of what I call the pessimistic, that you can keep writing and write. You know, all his stories about exiles, wanderers, people wandering, they're depressed, they're trying to go someplace, but they never get there. Nothing is ever satisfying. And of course, he's a German born at the end of the Second World War. He's clearly haunted by Germany's role in the war. And the idea that, so it seems to be the opposite of Fénelon in a certain way, that you can write as much as you want, but you will still never be able to even start to say what you want to say. And I became very interested in these figures while I was writing my other book. And I kept thinking, I have to do something with these people because it's so interesting, you know?
Yeah, and you obviously did. So we could just put in a publicity here, so to read the book. It's available in Norwegian and so forth. And you could also, of course, get it in English. But how does Well, there's another question first. Is there a necessary difference in how we categorize books, as you say, between nonfiction and fiction? Because when I read your book here, The Three Rings, I know it's actually your exploration of something that would maybe qualify for a nonfictional book. But then again, I have the feeling of reading fiction in another sense. So it's very difficult to categorize this for me when it comes to this book, and probably also, well, it's up to you. What do you think?
This is one of the really most interesting questions, particularly now, and there's so much interesting writing being done that's sort of blurring the traditional boundaries of fiction and nonfiction. You know, because what I would say is, so yes, people always say to me, well, you know, your book, The Lost or An Odyssey, my first book, The Elusive Embrace, and now Three Rings, they said it's hard to tell what genre they are. I'm mixing these different genres, literary criticism, memoir. There's a personal element. There's an intellectual element. But it's all, I hope, you know, written in a way that is a story. Mm-hmm. I'm making a story rather improbably out of intellectual things and personal things. So people say, well, it's like fiction. But I always say, it's not like fiction. It's like a story. You know, a good story doesn't have to be fiction in order to be a good story. And that's what I always remind people, that that's why I'm so happy that, you know, in within my career as a writer in the last 30 years, this idea of narrative nonfiction has emerged in the States as a kind of category that, in other words, it's true. It's a memoir or it's something like this, which mixes different genres, but it's self-consciously a narrative, a sort of satisfying story. And I think, you know, just because something's not fiction doesn't mean it doesn't have a successful quality of storytelling. It has a shape. It feels like a satisfying narrative. And to go back, Matilda, to something you started by saying, you know, the whole division of literature into fiction and nonfiction is completely crazy when you think. People who follow me on Twitter are very amused because whenever this comes up, I'm quite ferocious about it, you know, because the unconscious identification of literature with fiction drives me absolutely crazy. You know, and people do it and they're not even aware of it. You know, people will say, you know, even the New York Times, the best literature this year, and it's always novels. And I always say, why are only novels considered to be literature, as if everything is somehow less, you know? And I think as a classicist, I can tell you, and I know you're also very interested in the Greek and Roman classics, I think the Greeks would have been shocked by the idea of dividing literature into fiction and nonfiction. You look at these ancient biographies, they're completely filled with made up stuff. What they were interested was a good story. So for example, Xenophon, the historian, the Athenian historian, wrote a quote unquote life of the biography of the Persian emperor, Cyrus the Great. Which is, it's like fairy tales, you know. What was important for him were accumulating these satisfying stories. Whether they were true or not may have been incidental, you know. So that's a fairly, I think, a modern almost post 19th century or 19th century and after notion that literature has to be divided into seemingly fact and fiction. I think it's a crazy way to think about things, you know.
I will stop immediately thinking about it that way.
No, well, good. As you can tell, I get very evangelical on this point.
but you're right.
But because what you're saying is basically, look, when you read a great historian, it's quote unquote true or factual, let's say, as much as possible. But if it's told as a great story, when you think of the best biographies, the best histories, that's literature to me.
Yeah, and if you bear in mind that the story will tell you something, which obviously a story would, then of course you can reflect on if it's true or not. But anyway, the point of making the story is a truth in itself. It's why you choose to bring it into to the book, has something behind it.
Of course, and of course that has to work for fiction too.
Yeah.
You know, what is fiction? It's things that are not true, that say true things about the world.
I was coming back to the circular and linear question, which I think you've already answered. So I'll ask another question about how. What would you think characterize good literature? Because you, how do you experience this literature or good literature, by analysis or by feeling? Because as the listeners know, you also, as you said, you are writing critics for, you're looking at other people's literature as well. So tell us a little bit about that.
It's funny. I was speaking last week when I was in Bergen to a group of Norwegian critics, and I was saying literary criticism is such a strange enterprise because you're basically, it's about taking the purely subjective and trying to make it look purely objective. You know? So ultimately it comes down to taste based on a certain amount of expertise. You know, you've read a lot, you have a lot of basis for comparison, but at the end of the day, it's really your personal feeling about a work. To me, the absolute hallmark of a really good work of literature, you know, is a kind of density, let's call it, a kind of texture, you know, a sense that you can always go back to it. To me, a literary work is something you can go back to and always read again with profit, you know, that you will always get something out of it, even if you've read it before. So it's not something you read for the story. And once you know the story, you don't care anymore, you know. And I think to me, this is, I'm not laying down the law for anybody, but to me, I like a certain kind of density, a richness of texture. Style, I think, is very important. You know, it's like people, with an author, it's just like a person. Someone has an interesting personality. They have a flair for telling a story. That's what I want in a novel, say, or I correct myself, in anything, you know. Do you sense a powerful personality? You know, I've been reading with my older son, rereading for me and for him often the first time, a lot of Charles Dickens. And you think, you know, in some way, these are now 200 years old, these novels almost. And, you know, a lot of the attitudes, the social conditions, the context are all finished, you know, and yet you read these books and you're completely swept away. You know, the personality is unmistakable. Jane Austen, too. She has a personality, you know, that comes through. And these, to me, are very strong markers of a real literary event. You know, the sense of a voice, an attitude. And I'm reading D.H. Lawrence now, this incredible forcefulness of the narrator and a style that isn't like anybody else. To me, that's what makes literature exciting, but it's true also of course, nonfiction as well. You know, I was reading a bunch of essays recently by Marguerite Yourcenar, the French writer, nonfiction essays. You know, just one is about Piranesi, one is about, you know, different writers that she likes. But that sense of the personality coming through, you know, it's as if you're with a fascinating person at a dinner party and all you want to do is listen to them talk. And to me, that is the most vital thing about literature, the sense of the voice, you know.
And that's why probably we still read 200, 300,000 years old books, because they can stand the test of time.
Of course. You know, and look, it doesn't, I'm not saying everything has to be great. You know, I'm not saying everything has to be the Iliad or War and Peace or, you know, it can't be. And you don't want it to be either, you know, but even in a small book, you know, so to speak, even in a, you know, the sense of a real style that comes through is a very satisfying thing.
And we are closing in for an end, but I can't leave you or let you go before you tell me a bit about the Odyssey process, because there are certain facts that you've been interested in it for many, many years. You've chosen to have a course on it, teach students about it. It's obviously a very important book to you. And also, I've seen somewhere that you, as a small boy or a young boy maybe, chose to build the Parthenon temple.
Models. I was a great model maker when I was a kid. Maker. Yeah.
And that is probably question two in this question. Then you used your hands. Mm. By building, you have to click glue and to maybe, find pieces that fits together and so forth. And can you compare that process to being a builder when you write?
Yes, and as you know, this business of models becomes very important in my new book. actually in the work of Zabel, there's a very important moment that has to do with a model of an ancient building, you know. So when I was a kid, I was already very interested, as you were, in ancient Greek myths.
Yeah, the man in the barn. Builds the temple.
Yes, in this Zabel novel, there's a British fellow, a retired pastor, who's trying to build a model of the Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. And he's being driven mad because the more detailed he tries to make it, the slower the work goes. And he'll never finish, you know. So it becomes a symbol, I think. So I take that because I myself really did love to make models. And I made a series of models of the Parthenon, the great temple of Athena in Athens. And I think I reflect on that in the new book as a kind of metaphor for writing, actually, as you point out, you know, or a certain kind of writing, realistic writing, you know, but it goes back to Auerbach and this idea of what is a work of literature doing when it's trying to represent the real world? What are the techniques available to a writer to make something feel real? Homer tries, but so does T.H. Lawrence and Virginia Woolf, and they're all incredibly different. So how can there be so many different ways? But to me, the model is itself a kind of model, so to speak. The physical model of a building or, you know, whatever. I used to make airplanes when I was a kid, boats, you know. It represents both the joy and the frustration of representing, you know, the pleasure and the detail and the sense that you're getting closer and closer, but also the frustration because no model can ever finally approach reality. And one is aware of this as a writer. You know, you always know in a certain way that you're doomed from the beginning because however much you describe, it can never replace the reality that you're trying to represent. But that's the greatness of the enterprise. You know, it's like Zeno's paradox. You can come closer and closer and closer, but you can never get there. But, you know, maybe we should not get there. Because then there would be no writing.
There will be no mysticism. There will be nothing else to reflect on. And then finally, why the Odyssey?
Well,
why did it become so important to you?
I think the Odyssey is, to me, what's interesting to me now, I can reflect on this in a more sophisticated way than when I first got interested in the Odyssey, which was 50 years ago, you know. I now understand that my attraction to the Odyssey is in some way because I think that Odysseus, the hero of the Odyssey, say in contrast to Achilles, the hero of the Iliad, who's a great warrior, Odysseus is two things. He is a wanderer, a traveler, but also an exile in the sense that he doesn't want to be traveling. He wants to get home. But also a storyteller. He's the first great narrator in Western literature. As you know, because you're familiar with the Odyssey, quite often he'll use his ability to tell lies, stories, to make things up, to flatter people with fake stories. So he is a figure of the writer, sort of anticipates the writer because he uses language to manipulate reality. You know, this is one of his epithets, you know, he is a man of great inventiveness.
He's a cunning man.
Polymechanios, right? He can make things up. And if you can make things up, you can make the world you want it. I mean, so it's about versus Achilles, say, who is a warrior.
He's using his body and his muscles, and Odysseus is using his head.
Yes, he's the first. So I used to say, one can no longer say this, that Odysseus sort of anticipates Woody Allen. You know, he's a hero of intellect. And that's why the girls love him, so to speak, you know, because he's smart. But the idea of a hero of the mind, all kidding aside, the idea of a hero of the mind is a fascinating one. And it's the first time, you know, and as you know, and I know you were interested in this, and it's not an accident that his patron god
is Athena,
who is the goddess of wisdom and intelligence and cleverness. So the whole idea that you could heroize intelligence and make it a weapon, right, that it has real world effects is astonishing, you know, and his use of language, people who have read the Odyssey know one of the great episodes in the Odyssey is how he tricks this giant, this one-eyed giant, the Cyclops, with a pun, actually a pun he uses to overcome this giant who's eating his sailors, you know. So the idea that of language as a tool and also narrative as a tool is of course going to be attractive to some future writer. You know, I think writers love Odysseus because he is a kind of proto author in a way. And I'm sure now, looking back at my own life, that a great part of the attraction of this epic is about this hero. And I must say also his wife, Penelope, who turns out to be just as clever.
We haven't talked about her, but we don't have the time. But she's also very interesting. And then finally, maybe we should say that the Odyssey is still worth reading for people who wants to dig into what you just said, because about storytelling, about how language and words can be used, that can be, as we mentioned very briefly, very dangerous in politics, but it could also be used for something good, you think?
Yes, absolutely. Look, of course it can be used for something good or else there would be no writers, you know. But Odysseus himself is both attractive and sometimes unscrupulous. So I think the Odyssey already understands that there are two sides to manipulating language, and one side is not very attractive.
Yeah. Well, we can't just end on that. Not very attractive.
It's
we have to say something positive. We have to be like Fenelon. So what would you say?
Well, you know what? In 30 seconds, well, let's talk about Penelope, who is a match for her husband. And that's why we know they are the right for each other. Because the famous story about Penelope is how she's desperately trying to fend off these over 100 young men who are trying to marry her. And she uses this trick of promising that she will marry one of them as soon as she's finished weaving this garment for her father-in-law, a funeral shroud, actually. It's very symbolic. And then every night she unweaves what she has woven that day in order to infinitely put off the final moment where she will marry them. And it seems that also, Matilda, is a metaphor about narrative. It's like 1001 Nights. What if you can just keep it going forever? That's a different kind of circularity. So I think both in the female hero and in the male hero of this text, both are very interested in the different possibilities. Odysseus wants to come home. He wants to have a narrative with an ending. Penelope, to stay alive and faithful, has to keep delaying the ending. And that, it seems to me, is a wonderful note to end on, because there's two possibilities of telling a story.
Yes, and she is really strong. So the female thing here is important. She is not like put in some obscure place. She's very central to the Odyssey as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Thanks a lot for joining me today, Daniel.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you.
And to your listeners, Daniel Mendelssohn's books, they are available from Perez Forlag, his latest Tre Ringer, en beretning om eksil og skjebne. But also the other books are available in Norwegian and also, of course, in English. If you like Liberal Halvtime, rate us and recommend us, so give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or to my colleague eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita is available on our homepage, www.civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.